Welcome to the APM podcast. APM is the chartered body for the project profession. My name is Emma DeVita and I'm the editor of Project, APM's quarterly journal and your host. Today I'm speaking again with Bent Flubier, the first BT professor and inaugural chair of major programme management at the University of Oxford's Said Business School, who has just published a new book together with journalist Dan Gardner called How Big Things Get Done, The Surprising Factors Behind Every Successful Project, From Home Renovations to Science Exploration, published by Macmillan. Avid podcast listeners might remember I spoke to Bent back in March 2021 about how to make your projects a success, in which he spoke about reference class forecasting, one of the ways in which to help ensure the realistic planning, budgeting and setting of expected benefits for your projects. Bent formulated the iron law of megaprojects that contends that $1 billion plus megaprojects, rail, tunnels, nuclear power stations, Olympic Games, will almost always blow their budget and schedule and yield fewer benefits than promised. His new book outlines how the data shows this is no mystery. It's usually the result of terrible forecasting and planning. The good news is that he explains how every project, from a house renovation to the building of a new nuclear power station, can be done far more successfully. In fact, his approach, which hinges on his reference class forecasting tool, will, he hopes, help us to get to grips with the most critical mega project of all, the climate change emergency we all face. Bent, hello, welcome back to the APM podcast. I'm delighted to have you back.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me again.
Let's get down to your book, How Big Things Get Done, The Surprising Factors Behind Every Successful Project, From Home Renovations to Space Exploration. Firstly, I wanted to congratulate you on such a gripping read, which is not something I usually say about most business books. Why did you want to write this particular book when you did?
Because I had to do something during the pandemic. But I'd started thinking about it before the pandemic and planning it. And the reason that I wanted to do it was that I wanted to do something that was written in a more popular fashion, you know, where you didn't have to be an academic or a professional project manager in order to understand what we were saying in the book. But it was written in a language where pretty much any person could pick it up and understand what it was about and also understand that it actually relates to their life. It's not just about these big projects you hear about in the news like HS2 or a new skyscraper somewhere in the world. It's also about the projects we do in our daily lives, like you know, organizing a holiday or a wedding or doing a home renovation is an example we love and we use in the book. So we also wanted to write about project management in a way that it became clear to people that this is actually about your life. It's not about something that is happening only in professional circles. It's also happening in your daily life.
One of the messages that really stuck with me is this, the central idea of think slow, act fast. Could you explain to listeners what this actually means and how it should be applied to projects?
The first thing I want to say is that some people rebel against things slow because they think it means take a long time. And it doesn't necessarily mean that. It means that you need to slow down your thinking in accordance with the findings in behavioral economics. So you know Daniel Kahneman's book called Thinking Fast and Slow. It's about, we have these two ways of thinking. And one is our spontaneous way that we use as a fallback position, which is the fast way. So we think fast. And that gets us into a lot of trouble. So there's probably a good reason in evolutionary terms that we have this ability to think really fast, you know. But some things are not suited for that. And I would say that a big project is the kind of thing that is not suited for fast thinking, that you actually need to carefully consider what you're doing, because the fact that it's big means that it has big consequences, including on your own life. It's one of your private projects. So we basically use the results from behavioral economics and behavioral science and saying, okay, this is a very, very well-documented finding that we actually need to think slow to be successful. Behavioral economics don't go further than that, but we go further. We take the action side in because, of course, that's important when you're doing projects. It's all about action. There's a project isn't worth much if it's all just thinking or words on paper. It needs to happen in reality, and that's where the action comes in. And we've studied projects very carefully. And many people actually think the bigger the project you do, the more risky and difficult it is. And we find that's actually not, that's not the main problem. There's a bit of truth to that, but not much actually. The main thing is the longer it takes, the more risky it is and the higher risk of going terribly wrong. So it's actually time that is the killer for projects, not size. And this is something that has never been documented before, that it's actually about time and not size. Time is the killer. So that's why we say act fast. So by acting fast, you can actually reduce your risks enormously, especially if you have been thinking slow first. So that's why we say the rhythm of success in projects is think slow, act fast.
So when you say act fast, and if you act slower, there's higher risk, can you spell out why that is? Is it because you've got a greater window open to events that might disrupt the project?
Exactly. That's the key, the window and how big the window is. And we call it the window of doom. And that's very well founded. I mean, this is based on hard research. And because the bigger you make the window, which means the bigger you make the period that you're delivering in, the higher the risk is that something bad is going to fly through that window and smash up your project. Black swans, for instance, to use the term that Nassim Nicholas Taleb has made popular. That it actually turns out that the risk of black swans derailing your project goes up exponentially with the longer the time you take. So it's very risky to take a long time in terms of black swans. And this is a very important, maybe the most important finding in the book, in my own point of view, is that the vast majority of projects have fat tails regarding performance. So projects are black swan inclined. And that means that the best thing you can do to reduce that black swan risk and other risks, to emphasize, is to reduce that window by keeping it short. And we study successful project leaders who are doing exactly that. Probably the most famous right now is Elon Musk. You know, he's been extremely successful in his company. So that's Tesla and SpaceX in using these principles that we are describing in the book, like getting to production really fast and thinking things through very carefully before you start actually doing things.
And how do you square the thinking slow with the current appetite for agile and iterative thinking and just doing something and pivoting and experimenting?
So I want to distinguish between two types of projects, projects that are easily reversible, where you can very easily reverse your decisions and it doesn't matter much, you know, whether you did something and you have to redo it. And that's what agile is good for, situations where you can easily reverse your decisions and you can get a learning process going and then you just you revise. So this is common in software and that's where agile comes from, right? But I don't mean to say that agile should be limited to just software. It's actually a very useful method in lots of contexts. But software is particularly suitable because you're not building anything physical and it's quite easy to change things. And that's why you talk about minimum viable products also in agile, right? You just build a minimum viable product, you market, put it to market, you test it, and then you just take it back again and you fix things that don't work and you improve it. Then you send it out again and you go through iterations like that. That's fine for projects that are easily reversible, but projects that are not reversible, so irreversible projects, you can't do that. So for instance, if you're putting on a wedding, it's not a good idea just to try a little wedding, you know, and then see how it goes. And then you do another one, you know, the same thing, like if you're building a skyscraper, how on earth would you say, okay, we're going to put up a skyscraper. If it doesn't work, we take it down again. And then we do another one. That would be agile, right? Doesn't work. So you have to make a very clear distinction between reversible and irreversible decisions. Most big projects are actually irreversible. Now, they don't have to be. Some big software projects can be built in an agile fashion, and some change management projects can be done in an agile fashion where you're just changing organizational structures and organizational processes and so on, and where it's not that big of a deal if you make a mistake and have to redo it. But anything, you know, like you're building a tunnel under the channel between the UK and France, you can't just start boring and then say, OK, if it's not working, we'll start boring somewhere else.
Why does thinking slow and acting fast not usually happen?
Because we are programmed to not do this. We are hardwired from nature, from biology, for whatever reason. probably very good revolutionary reasons. We have something called availability bias, that whatever pops into our brain first and makes itself available as a thought, and this could be a thought about a project or an idea for a project, we tend to tag onto that and then disregard all sorts of other things. We actually kind of lose perspective because we already have a perspective, namely the first thought that came into our mind. This is very well documented, again, in behavioral science and behavioral economics, that we have this, and this is something to watch out for. And that's why we think fast. We just jump to the first thing, and then we assume that this is all there is. Kahneman has a word for it. He called it WYSIWYG, which is a terrible acronym. But that's what he calls it. It stands for what you see is all there is. So what you see is all there is. That's an extremely strong cognitive bias we have. And Kahneman spends a large part of his book describing this and how it trips us up. So that's what's happening in projects, is that we quickly latch on to some idea, maybe even a specific technology that we're going to use for this project. And then that's all we see. What we see is all there is. And we run with that. Instead of stepping back and saying, okay, now I have one idea. Now let me start to think about some other ideas. And we give very clear guidance in the book and take the reader's hand and walk the reader through processes that you can use to step back and think more systematically about what are the alternatives here? What are the many other ways that we could do this? And then decide which of these ways are you going to use. One of our main means is to ask why. We encourage anybody who's doing a project to first sit down and ask themselves or whoever is doing this project, why are you doing the project? Why? And you need to have a very good answer to that question before you start. So you actually know precisely and very well thought out what the reasons are that you are doing the project. Then after you know that, you can start thinking backwards. From that's really the end product you want to end up with. Then you work backwards through the Gantt diagram and to the left side of the diagram, and then you start thinking about how do I deliver the why, and what's the best way to do that. That's a way to avoid falling into this trap of committing to a bad idea up front, which is very common. And if you do that, then you get the opposite of thinking slow, acting fast. You get think fast, act slow. Because if you haven't thought out what you are going to do, then all sorts of problems are going to pop up when you can least afford it and when it's really going to slow you down, which is in the delivery phase.
I wanted to ask you about thinking right to left. So that connects with what you were saying just then about what is it? Why are you doing this project? What do you hope the outcomes to be?
So thinking right to left is referring to the process chart that is used in most project planning and management. So the Gantt chart, classically, where you have the end result, the outcome on the right, and then everything that needs to happen left of that. So you start all the way on the left, and then you eventually end up on the right. We say reverse that process, start on the right, then work your way backwards to the left, and then you start delivery while you keep your eyes on the right so you know that at all times that anything you do is contributing to what's on the right of the diagram. And the right is established by the question why. That's why you ask the why question. Why are we doing this? Well, we are doing it because we want this and that. This is your end results. So the why question helps you put the right thing on the right of the diagram. And then you work backwards. And the key thing here is that this helps you having, you know, you're basically having a North Star that will lead you all the way through the project delivery process, no matter how complex it is and how much you tend to get lost in the weeds from time to time. If you look up and you look at what's out there on the right, you know where what you should be aiming for. And then you just look down and see, is what I'm doing now actually contributing to that outcome? And if the answer is yes, keep doing what you're doing. If the answer is no, stop doing what you're doing and start doing something that actually contributes to the outcome. And very often people get lost in their projects, you know, they lose their way because it's not clear what's in the box on the right of the process diagram.
I was curious on your thoughts about optimism bias, and how you mitigate against that in a project.
Yeah, so we are saying that there are two big things that decide the fate of projects. One is psychology, the other is power. And the optimism bias is psychology. So this is probably the most well-established cognitive bias and the most researched cognitive bias that exists. Again, very well documented that we are hardwired to be optimists. And again, probably for good reason. We needed to get up in the morning and get to work and take care of our kids and do projects. Nobody, and certainly not me, would deny that we need optimism in our lives, and we need optimism in project management and project delivery. However, optimism can be misplaced. It can really get you into bad situations. Like, just imagine if you're getting on a plane and you hear the first pilot saying to the second pilot, "I'm optimistic about the fuel situation." I don't know about you, but I don't want to be on that plane. I want to get off. I don't want a pilot who's optimistic about the fuel situation. I want a pilot who's dead certain and realistic about the fuel situation. Now, what's the fuel of projects? The fuel of projects is money and time. We need money and time to fuel our projects to get to that box on the right, you know, of the diagram. I don't want to work with project leaders that are optimistic about the budget. I don't want to work with project leaders that are optimistic about the schedule, because I know that if that's the case, that we have a huge risk of crashing, just like the airplane would have if you're optimistic about the fuel situation. Now, I'm lucky. I get to work on a lot of projects because a lot of projects make this error. And then, you know, once they made the error, I get hired in to de-bias the project and get rid of the optimism and then see if we can we salvage the project, can we re-baseline it, and then make sure we have a realistic schedule and a realistic budget for delivering the rest of the project successfully. And there are, you know, very good ways of doing this, and there are different ways. So I've developed a method called reference class forecasting, but there are also something called similarity-based forecasting. Where you can before you even start the project, you can try to imagine everything that could go wrong with it. So that's called a pre-mortem. You actually pick the project apart before you start it and see, okay, if everything goes wrong, what could happen here? And then you protect yourself against all these things. So there are many ways you can de-bias projects. It's called, there's a common term for this now that is emerging called decision hygiene. This is a kind of hygiene that you need to do on your decisions to make them sound, you know, and healthy. To make a healthy decision, you need decision hygiene. De-biasing is part of decision hygiene. We very much need that on projects.
How important is the politics side of things, and how as a project manager or project leader do you prepare yourself as best you can to deal with that side of things?
So we have a heuristic about that, and we call it build your bridges before you need them. It's too late to start developing stakeholder relations when you need the stakeholders to help you when things start going wrong with your project. You need to have built those relations. So those are the bridges that I'm talking about. You need to build those bridges before you need them, so that they are there when you need them and you can cross them. You can communicate with the stakeholders and you can ask them for help, you know, to get the project back on track. So that's the stakeholder management part of things. And it's really important, incredibly important. And we find that the many, many successful project leaders that we have studied for the book, including interviewing them, but also studying their work, you know, directly, they all do this. One successful IT project manager who's managing multi-billion dollar and multi-billion pound IT projects, said that when he's leading one of these huge IT projects, he's spending more than half his time on stakeholder management. He's like a diplomat, you know, out there trying to make sure that the project has good relations with everybody. And that's, in his view, that's what he needs to spend his time on. And then he's bringing in people to do the more technical stuff and actually running the project. He's just out there way in front of the project, making sure that relations are good so that when they hit a bump in the road, they actually have the relations they need in order to get over it. So that's a way You can call it, like you say, managing politics, because that's the sort of the micro politics of the project is what do the stakeholders think about the project? Will they support it or will they be against it? And that's very important for the project leader and the project leader team to be aware of. Of course, there are many other ways that politics can play a part. So one way that we talk about in the book is the politics of manipulating the business case up front in order to get it approved. And that's another type of bias. We call it power bias. So on one side, we have psychology that we talked about, and there you have the cognitive biases, of which optimism bias is the most prominent. On the power side, you have people deliberately manipulating things. So on the psychology side, it's non-deliberate. People are actually not conscious of their own biases. So optimists are not conscious, mostly not conscious. They are optimistic when they're making their decisions. They actually think they are making realistic decisions when they are making optimistic decisions. With political and power bias, it's different. People actually know what they're doing. They are manipulated. It's called cooking the numbers. In the US, they call it cooking the numbers. So you cook the books, and you cook the business case so that the project looks cheap. You know, it's much easier to get a project approved that has a low budget. And the same with schedule. You cook the schedule so that it looks short, and it's much easier to get a project approved that looks like it can be delivered quickly. So that's power bias. And it has exactly the same effect as psychological bias, except it's deliberate. But these two biases, the psychological biases and the power biases, actually reinforce each other and create these very unhealthy business cases that we see for the vast majority. And I cannot emphasize enough how big that majority of projects is that have bad business cases.
Well, if you're an experienced project manager or project leader, do you become aware, do you think, that you have this optimism bias, so that the more projects you have under the belt, the more you realize that actually you need to be somehow turn your optimism dial down?
So it will keep happening to some degree, but successful product leaders do get their optimism bias and other biases under control. They're anchoring in the wrong base rates, for instance. That's a classic, you know, that you totally underestimate the risks. That's also a type of optimism, right? And it's called the base rate fallacy. And it's, again, a very well-established fallacy in behavioral economics. And this is the kind of thing that successful product leaders get over, these big pitfalls. But that doesn't mean that nobody is perfect regarding psychological bias. It would basically mean that you would have to take your brain out and put another brain in there, because it's truly hardwired for this. You can get rid of, I would say 50 to 70% of your biases if you're very, very good, but you will have those 30 to 50% bias still, you know. And Kahneman argues something like the same in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, and other publications that he did. So I think that's, again, also a pretty solid thing. But it doesn't mean that it's not worth debiasing. It really is. And what I find with really successful product leaders, and I've been very fortunate. We worked with many for many, many years, and some of them we interviewed for the book, and new ones we interviewed for the book. And I find they all have this really attractive disposition in their personalities of being realistic optimists. So they're really realistic about what are the odds in the field that we are playing in. They're like somebody going to the casino and totally understanding the odds, not being optimistic about you'll win on the roulette, you know, if you know what the real odds are. But at the same time, having an optimistic can-do attitude, you know, of course we can find a way to get this project done if we have this realism at the outset. We are not building a pie in the sky. We're building something real. We know what the laws of physics are and the laws of economics, etc., laws of organization. We abide by it all. We think slow. We really think about what we are doing. We iterate, as we call it in the book. We experiment. We do things over and over and over again in order to learn before we start building in the real world, so that we don't make the mistakes that we do during the experimentation on the ground once we are building and it's expensive. That's how the successful project leaders work. And it's really stimulating to see people working like that.
Mm. So, I mean, one of the pieces of advice in your book is that if you're embarking on a project, that you should try and find the most experienced people to be on the team and to lead that project. Is that not commonplace?
It doesn't happen that often. It happens, but it doesn't happen nearly often enough, unfortunately. People don't think enough about it. That's another of these, thinking fast things that, hey, we have a leader here. He or she can probably do this project. Let's get going, you know. And instead of spending the time of thinking about what kind of leader do we need here, we have a heuristic for that too. We call it hire a master builder. So we call these very successful project leaders for master builders. And the term comes from the Middle Ages, you know, where you called the famous architects and builders who built the cathedrals of Europe. So the famous cathedrals that we have and still admire today were built by people who really knew what they were doing mostly, and they got the name master builders. So we decided to use that name for today, you know, in the contemporary world, for people who are really good at delivering projects, no matter what type of projects. They don't have to be cathedrals, you know. They don't even have to be buildings. It can be, like we talk about master builders at Pixar, for instance, to take an example. So that's what we call them. And they are not being hired enough. I was to give you an example. I was an expert witness on a big hydroelectric dam in Canada that had gone terribly wrong. So the usual pattern, huge cost overruns, huge delays, not delivering what we were supposed to deliver and not at the time it was supposed to do it, et cetera, et cetera. So they decided to have, an inquiry headed by a preeminent judge, you know, so really serious and with, with the firepower that you get when you can pull people in and question them and people have to answer. And I was an expert witness on that. And it turned out during the inquiry that the people who were hired to build the dam had never built a dam before. Never. Can you imagine? This is a multi-billion dollar hydroelectric dam and you decide to choose somebody to build it who's never built a dam before. And now this is one thing. And it's okay, and this is actually what got me started researching mega projects, was I was thinking, is this normal? You have these crazy stories like the one I just told you from one-off mega projects in different places around the world. And I started wondering, is this normal? Is there a pattern here? We had one in Denmark that similarly went wrong for the same reasons, actually. So what they did in Canada was they figured, you know, it's actually difficult right now to find somebody who can build a dam like this in Canada. But we are doing a lot of oil and gas projects. So we actually have a lot of project leaders who are used to building multi-billion dollar oil and gas projects. And listen, you know, how difficult can it be if you know how to build one big project, you know how to build another big project. So let's hire somebody from oil and gas and let them build the dam. Now, that's what I mean by this is not slow thinking. That's for sure. That's fast thinking. Let's find a quick solution. And it costs billions of dollars. That's what happens, you know, when you do it like that. So, yeah. So it's a kind of laziness of not wanting to go through the slow thinking and really do everything you can to find the master builders. But there's also a real problem, and that is there's not enough talent around. So the world is building more and more big projects at an incredible rate right now. So we are just getting more and bigger projects across the board, across the panel. So there's a lot of demand for people who can do this. So they're not enough. It's simple as that, the demand far outstrips the supply of talent in this field. And that means you actually might have to grow your own talent, but then you have to be aware of it. You can't just assume that whoever you hire can build the project if you are hiring people who doesn't have the talent that you need for building your project. And that assumption is often made. And that's another heuristic we have, don't assume, verify. And we find that, you know, big projects are littered with assumptions that are wrong, you know, like one thing after another is assumed and nobody bothers to spend the time to verify whether it's actually the case. And therefore, the projects go wrong very quickly because they are built on wrong assumptions.
What advice would you give to project professionals who are just starting out in their career about what they need to focus on or what they need to do in order to manage their projects successfully and to become successful project leaders in the future?
So first of all, it is a great time to be in the project management and project leadership field because there's a lot of demand and it's very easy to get a job. And I encourage my students, you know, to to choose this field, and of course choose the areas that are going up. So I actually have a lot of students who are concerned about being in oil and gas. So oil and gas is a huge field in major projects. It's been around forever, you know, for decades and decades and decades. And now, you know, things are not, but right now they're going well because the prices of oil are up again. But if you sort of look at it at the last 10 years and the next 10, 20 years, it's probably not the field to be in. And like I tell my students, why do you want to be in an elevator that's going down if you can be on one that's going up, you know? And there are other areas, and it's easy to get jobs in other areas. So that's one thing I would say. This is great fields to get into, but do be concerned and think slow about which of the many different areas, different project types that exist, is it that you actually want to do. And I would say, right now, I would advise against going into oil and gas. I would advise against going into nuclear, unless you're on a team that's trying to develop SMRs, small modular reactors, which might have a future, but we don't know. Nuclear is a very unproven technology, incredibly as it sounds, because we've been doing nuclear for 50 years and at least, but it's still unproven and it doesn't work. It's way too expensive. That's just the effect of nuclear right now. It's only economics, nothing ideological about whether nuclear is good or bad or dangerous or not. It's about economics, and it's too expensive. It's that simple. So that's one thing. Be careful about what you choose. Then after that, you know, if you're young and entering the field, make sure you get to work on a project where your leaders are not the kind of people that I talked about in Canada. They're people who have never tried to build a project before and they're doing it. That's not what you want to learn how to do. You want to find a master builder, and then you want to work with that master builder and watch that master builder work so that you can be a kind of an apprentice, or just watch things and work on a team, you know, that really works because it is well lit. That's the kind of team you want to get on, and not on the majority of teams that are learning by making mistakes, you know. I mean, you have to make some mistakes, but it's much more efficient to be on a team that is led by somebody who's successful. So that's the second thing I would do if I was starting a career now. And that's what I advise my students to do. Now, back to the thing about nuclear. So we studied 25 different product types in the book regarding their performance, and nuclear comes out at the very bottom with IT projects, actually, and with hydroelectric dams and with storage of nuclear waste. These are the worst performing projects in terms of being black swan prone, meaning that they have extreme outliers in regards of cost and cost overrun and schedule overrun, etc. They're difficult to manage, and they end up being very expensive. That's what we can't do. We can't afford it. And if we're going to solve the climate crisis, if we right now were deciding to focus on those projects, we wouldn't be able to do it in time. 2030 and 2050, which are the timelines for solving the climate crisis, just would not be met. You know, there was no way to do it. It's way too slow, even in China. So we have something that we call a natural experiment in China, where China has really tried to ramp up all forms of power production that don't produce CO2. And of course, nuclear is one of them. And they just can't ramp it up. It's too difficult. Even in China, where you don't have the safety and environmental regulations that you have in countries like the US and the UK and Europe, the Chinese can't do it. And we take that to mean that you just can't do it. It's not doable. Nobody can do it right now. Luckily, this is actually not where the focus is in solving the climate crisis. The focus is on renewables now, and especially solar and wind are the two best performing projects of the 25 project types that we study. They are way out there in terms of good performance. They are actually outliers. It's crazy, but average practice in project management is a disaster, and good practice is an outlier. It's the exact opposite of what you usually say when you talk about these things, but it's a fact, you know, and it's documented in the book. For the first time, this is actually a brand new research result that we have is comparing these 25 different product types. There's a nice diagram that shows it in one overview, which projects are performing well and which are not. And luckily, you know, the projects that we need in order to solve the climate crisis are doing extremely well, and they perform really well. They are done really fast. And we also identify what the reason is, you know, for this.
Which is the modularity, isn't it?
Exactly. So that's where I use the term Lego. So I'm Danish, and Lego is a Danish brand. It's the biggest toy manufacturer in the world now, and which attests to the popularity of Lego. And why are Lego so popular and important in kids' lives? I grew up with them. I remember stepping on them as a child and hurting my feet, you know, all over our house. And I find that no matter where I go in the world and talk about Lego, people understand what it is. And that's why I like to use it as a metaphor for what it is that works in project management. It's actually the projects that you can build like you build it with Legos. And I'm saying that the sound of a successful project is click, click, click. It's like putting building blocks together, like you put Legos together, click, click, click. And if you look at it, look at what a wind farm is, you know, it's a bunch of wind turbines, and each wind turbine consists of four Legos. So there's one Lego that is the foundation, there's one Lego that is the tower, there's one Lego that is nacelle, which is where the turbine itself is sitting, and then there are the wings or the blades, you know, that you click on the nacelle. So you click the tower on the foundation, you click the nacelle on the tower, you click the blades on the nacelle, and you have a wind turbine, and it's actually ready to produce electricity immediately. And these giant wind turbines are put up in less than 24 hours now. Multi-billion dollar wind farms used to take years to do. Now they are built in 7 months. 7 months for a multi-billion dollar project is unheard of. That's exactly what we need in order to solve the climate crisis. And that's exactly thinking slow, acting fast, you know, in a nutshell.
How optimistic do you feel about the way mega projects or projects are going to be delivered in the future? Do you feel optimistic that there will be greater success?
I'm pretty optimistic. I mean, this is one of the things we discovered while doing the book, that I find that there's more reason to be optimistic than I thought there was. And I was already pretty optimistic, you know, because, I mean, I've seen a lot of things going well on the projects that I've been working on. And I'm seeing that spreading. There's more and more interest. There didn't used to be much interest about these things. Now there's massive interest everywhere in the world for the simple reason that we are doing so many and so large projects like we talked about earlier. So I'm optimistic. And I'm especially optimistic about the discovery that it's already happening. It's amazing to see how fast renewables are being built out. And I want to emphasize, and people often think when I'm negative on nuclear and I'm positive on renewables, that's something ideological and political. I'm an economic geographer. I'm looking at the economics of this, and this is purely based on the economics. Solar and wind are dirt cheap, and they're getting cheaper every year. Nuclear is incredibly expensive, and it's getting more and more expensive the more we try to build it, because we can't figure out how to build it right and how to build it cheap, you know, and therefore the price is going up. Well, any economist who gets that information will know that one of these things is not going to work and the other is, and it's very clear which is which here. And that's a very positive thing, that we are actually lucky in the situation that we are in, where solving the energy crisis is probably the most pressing problem that we have ever had as a species, that we just happen to have a technology that is spreading like wildfire right now. Even the most optimistic organizations like Greenpeace and you know, green organizations for wind and solar and so on, underestimated how fast it would develop, that they actually thought it would take much longer than it has done, even to this date, you know. And instead of taking a generation to do it, it has taken like 9-10 years to get to where we thought it would take a generation. So what we thought would take 25 years has taken 9 to 10 years. So that's a really good reason to be optimistic. And that's just energy. There are lots of other reasons to be optimistic in other areas.
Thank you so much. I think we've really got across what your book is about. So I would recommend listeners to get their hands on a copy, How Big Things Get Done. And that's out now by Macmillan. So Thank you again, Bent, for your time. It's been lovely speaking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me again.
Thanks again to Bent for joining us and to you for listening to this episode of the APM podcast. Don't forget to look out for more episodes or to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. We'd welcome you to get in touch with your comments, feedback and suggestions by emailing us at apmpodcast@thinkpublishing.co.uk. This podcast has been brought to you by APM, the chartered body for the project profession. For more information on APM, visit apm.org.uk.